determined. "I ain't lying," he said flatly. "I rode all night to get here, slipping out of camp on the quiet. She rode in with that gunman, Laredo Shad, and this Kedrick hombre."
"Kedrick? Alive?" Keith sat forward, his face tense.
"Alive as you or me. Had him most of his hair clipped on one side of his head, and a bad scab there. He sort of favored his side, too. Oh, he'd been shot all right, but he's riding now, believe me."
The renegade had saved the worst until last. He smiled grimly at Berwick.
"I can use some money, Mr. Berwick," he said, "and there's more I could tell you."
Berwick stared at him, his eyes glassy hard, then reached into a drawer and threw two gold eagles on the desk.
"All right. What can you tell me?"
"Kedrick sent a message to some hombre in Washington named a Ransom. He's to block the sale of the land until there's a complete investigation."
"What?" Keith came to his feet, his face ashen. This was beyond his calculations. When the idea had first been brought to his attention, it had seemed a very simple, easy way to turn a fast profit. He had excellent connections in Washington through his military career, and with Berwick managing things on the other end, and Gunter with the money, it seemed impossible to beat it. He was sure to net a handsome profit, clear his business with Gunter and Berwick, then return east and live quietly on the profits. That it was a crooked deal did not disturb him, but that his friends in the east might learn of it.
"Ransom!" His voice was shocked. "Of all people!"
Frederick Ransom had served with him in the war, and their mutual relationship had been something less than friendly. There had been that episode by the bridge. He flushed at the thought of it, but Ransom knew, and Ransom would use it as a basis for judgment. Kedrick had no way of knowing just how fortunate his choice of Ransom had been.
"That does it." He got to his feet. "Ransom will bust this wide open, and love it."
He was frightened, and Berwick could see it. He sat there, his gross body filling the chair, wearing the same soiled shirt. His eyes followed Keith with irritation and contempt. Was Keith going bad on him now?
"Get back there," Berwick said to Hurst, "and keep me informed of all movements. Watch everything closely now, and don't miss a trick. You will be paid."
When Hurst had gone, Berwick turned to Keith and smiled with his fat lips.
"So, does it matter if they slow it up a little? Let them have their investigation. It will come too late."
"Too late?" Keith was incredulous. "With such witnesses against us as Kedrick, Shad, Connie, and the rest of them?"
"When the time comes," Berwick said quietly, "there will be no witnesses. Believe me, there won't be."
12. Keith turned on Berwick, puzzled by the sound of his voice.
"What do you mean?" he asked.
Berwick chuckled and rolled his fat lips on his cigar. There was malice and some contempt in the look he gave Keith. How much better, he thought, had Kedrick not been so namby-pamby. He was twice the man Keith was, for all the latter's commanding presence.
"Why," he said, "if there's no witnesses, there'll be no case. What can these people in town tell them? What they suspect? Suspicions won't stand in a court of law, nor with that committee. By the time they get here, this country will be peaceful and quiet, believe me."
"What do you want to do?" Keith demanded.
"Do? What is there to do? Get rid of Kedrick, Laredo Shad, and that girl. Then you'll take a posse and clean out that rat's nest back of the rim. Then who will they talk to? Gunter might have weakened, but he's dead. With the rest of them out of it."
"Not Connie," Keith protested. "Not her. For heaven's sake, man."
Berwick snorted, and his lips twisted in an angry sneer as he heaved his bulk from the chair.
"Yes, Connie," he said. "Are you a complete fool, Keith, or have you gone soft? That girl knows more than all of them. Suppose Gunter talked to her, and he most likely did. She'll know everything. Everything, I tell you."
He paced back across the room, measuring Keith. The fool. He was irritated and angry. The sort of man they made these days, a weak and sniveling crowd. Keith had played out his time. If he finished this job alive, well, Dorney didn't like Keith. Berwick chuckled suddenly. Dorney. Now there was a man. The way he had killed that Bob McLennan.
Now get this. Get the boys together. Get Fessenden, Goff, Clausen, Poinsett, and the Mixes boys and send them out with Dorney. I want those three killed, you hear me? I want them dead before the week is out. And no bodies, understand?
Keith touched his dry lips, his eyes haunted. He had bargained for nothing like this. It had all seemed such an easy profit, and only a few poverty-stricken squatters to prevent them from acquiring wealth in a matter of a few months. Everything had started off just as Berwick had suggested. Everything had gone so well. Gunter had provided the money, and he had fronted for them in Washington. Uneasily, now Keith realized that, if trouble was made over this, it would be he upon whom the blame would rest. Berwick, somehow, had been in the background in the East as much as he, Keith, had been kept in the background here. Yet it would be his guilt if anything went wrong, and with Ransom investigating, everything had gone wrong. He sighed deeply. Of course, Berwick was right. There was only one thing to do now. At least, Dorney and the others would not hesitate. Suddenly, he remembered something.
You mentioned Clausen. He's out of it, Berwick.
Clausen came in last night tied to his horse. He had been dead for hours.
What?
Berwick stopped his pacing and walked up to Keith.
You just remembered?
He held his face inches away from Keith's and glared.
Is anybody backtracking that horse? You blithering idiot. Clausen was dynamite with a gun. So if he's dead, shot, it has to be by one of three men, and you know it.
Berwick's face was dark with passion, and he wheeled and walked the length of the room, swearing in a low, violent voice that shocked Keith with its deep, underlying passion. When he turned again, Berwick's eyes were ugly with fury.
Can't you realize, he demanded hoarsely, those men are dangerous? That every second they are alive, we are in danger? You have seen Dorney in action. Well, believe me, I'd sooner have him after me than Kedrick. I know Kedrick. He's a former army officer, that's what you're thinking all the time, an officer and a gentleman. But he's something more, do you hear? He's more. He's a gentleman, that's true enough. But the man's a fighter. He loves to fight. Under all the calmness and restraint, there's a drive and power that Dorney Shaw could never equal. Dorney may be faster, and I think he is, but you don't forget for one instant that Kedrick won't be through until he's down. Down and dead.
Lauren Keith was shocked. In his years' association with Berwick, he had never seen the man in a passion, and he had never heard him speak with such obvious respect, and even, yes, even fear of any man. What had Alton Berwick seen that he himself had not seen? He stared at Berwick, puzzled and annoyed, but some of the man's feeling began to transmit itself to him, and he became distinctly uneasy. He bit his lips and watched Berwick pacing angrily.
It's not only him, but it's Shad, that cool, thin-faced Texan. As for Lane,
Berwick's eyes darkened,
he may be the worst of the lot. He thinks he has a personal stake in this.
Personal? Keith looked inquiringly at the older man. What do you mean? Berwick dismissed the question with a gesture.
No matter. They must go, all of them, and right now.
He turned and his eyes were cold.
Keith, you fronted us in Washington. If this thing goes wrong, you're the one who will pay. Now go out there and get busy. You've a little time and you've the men. Get busy!
When he had gone, Berwick dropped into his chair and stared blindly before him. It had gone too far to draw back even if he was so inclined, and he was not. The pity of it was that there had been no better men to be had than Keith and Gunter. Yet, everything could still go all right, for he would know how to meet any investigating committee, how to soft-pedal the trouble, turn it off into a mere cow-country quarrel of no moment and much exaggerated. The absence of any complaining witness would leave them helpless to proceed, and he could make it seem a mere teapot tempest. Keith was obviously afraid of Ransom. Well, he was not. Berwick was still sitting there when the little cavalcade of horsemen streamed by, riding out of town on their blood trail. The number had been augmented, he noticed, by four new arrivals, all hard, desperate men. Even without Keith, they might do the job. He heaved himself to his feet and paced across the room, staring out the window. It went badly with him to see Connie Duane die, for he had plans for Connie. Maybe. His eyes narrowed. Out on the desert, the wind stirred restlessly, and in the brassy sky above, a lone buzzard circled as if aware of the creeping tension that was slowly gripping the country beneath it. Far to the north, toward Durango, a cattle buyer pulled his team to a halt and studied the sky. There was no hint of storm, yet he had felt uneasy ever since leaving town on his buying trip down to Yellow Butte and Mustang. There had been rumors of trouble down that way. But then there had been intermittent trouble there for some time, and he was not alarmed. Yet he was somehow uneasy, as though the very air carried a warning. South of him, and below the rim, Laredo, Shad, and Kedrick turned aside from the Mustang Trail and headed toward Yellow Butte. It was only a little way out of their line of travel, but both men wanted to see what had happened there. Yet, when they approached the town, aside from the blackened ruins of the destroyed buildings, everything seemed peaceful and still. 8 or 10 families had moved back into town, and a few had never left. They looked up warily as the two riders drew near, then nodded a greeting. They knew now that these two were sided with them against the company, but hardship and struggle had wearied them, and they watched the two enter the settlement without excitement. The saloon had opened its doors in the large roomy office of the livery stable, and they went there now. A couple of men leaned on the bar, and both turned as they entered, greeted them, and returned to their conversation. It was growing cool outside, and the warmth of the room felt good. Both men stepped to the bar, and Kedrick ordered and paid. Shad toyed with his drink. He seemed uneasy, and finally he turned to Tom.
"I don't like it," he said, low-voiced. "Somehow or other, Berwick is going to know about Ransom, and he'll be in a sweat to get Connie out of the way, and you and me with her."
Kedrick agreed, for his own mind had been reading sign along the same trail. The only way out for the company now was to face the committee, if Ransom managed one, with a plausible tale and an accomplished fact, and then let them make the most of it.
"Berwick's a snake," Shad commented. "He'll never quit wiggling until the sun goes down for the last time. Not that one. He's in this deep, and he ain't the man to lose without a fight."
Horses' hoofs sounded on the road outside, and, when they turned, Pitt Lane and Day Reed were dismounting before the door. They walked in, and Lane looked at Kedrick, then moved on to the bar. Day looked worried, but said nothing. After a minute, Lane turned suddenly and went outside.
"What's the matter?" Kedrick asked.
"It'd be worry, and some of it shame, and all for that sister of his. Who would think it of her? To go over to the other side? He's that shy about it, you would scarcely believe. When a man looks at him, he thinks it's his sister they are thinking on, and how she's sold out to that traitor to mankind, that rascal Keith."
Kedrick shrugged.
"Ambition and money do strange things. She has the makings of a woman, too."
Lane opened the door.
"Better come out," he said. "We've got trouble."
They crowded outside. Men were hurrying toward the houses, their faces grave.
"What is it?" Kedrick asked quickly.
"Bert Williams signaled from the top of the butte. There's riders coming from Mustang, a bunch of them."
As they looked, the small dark figure of a man appeared on the edge of the mesa once more. This time they saw his arm wave, once, twice, 3 times, and continued until he had waved it 6 times. When he had completed, he gestured to the southeast. Then he signaled 4 more times from the southwest.
10 riders, Lane spat.
"Well, we've got more than that here, but they aren't as salty as that crowd."
Bert Williams, favoring his broken arm, knelt behind a clump of brush on top of Yellow Butte and studied the approaching horsemen through a glass. He knew all in this group by sight, but not by favor. One by one, he named them off to himself.
Keith, Dorney Shaw, Fessenden, and Goff. Poinsett. No, that's not Poinsett. That one's... the Mixis boys. Yep, and there's the other.
He swung his glass. The four riders, spaced well apart, were approaching at a steady pace. None of their faces was familiar. He stared at them a while, but finally placed only one of them, a bad man from Durango who ran with Port Stockton and the Ketchum outfit. His name was Brokaw. Stirred, he searched the country all around the town for other movement, then turned back to the larger cavalcade of riders. Had he held in a certain high flat a minute longer, he would have seen two unmounted men cross it at a stooping run and drop into the wide arroyo northeast of town. As it was, he had been studying the approaching group for several minutes before he realized that Poinsett was not among them. He was with neither group. Worried, William squinted his eyes against the sun, wondering how he could apprise them of the danger down below, for the absence of Poinsett disturbed him. The man was without doubt one of the most vicious of the company killers, a bitter man, made malignant by some dark happening in his past, but filled now with a special sort of venom all his own. Williams would have worried even more had he seen Poinsett at that moment. The attack had been planned carefully and with all of Keith's skill. He surmised who they would be looking for and hoped their watcher would overlook the absence of Poinsett, for it was he who Keith wanted in the right position, for Poinsett was unquestionably the best of the lot with a rifle. At that moment, not 200 yards from town, Poinsett and his companion, Alf Starrett, were hunkered down in a cluster of brush and boulders at one side of the arroyo. Poinsett had his Spencer 56 and was settling into position for his first shot. Starrett, with a 15-shot Henry 44, was a half dozen yards away. Poinsett pulled out a huge silver watch and consulted it.
At 2:30, he says. All right, that's when he'll get it.
With utmost composure, he began to roll a smoke, and Alf Starrett, a hard-faced and wizened little man, noticed his fingers were steady as he sifted tobacco into the paper. Bob McLennan had planned the defense of Yellow Butte, if such a defense became necessary, and while Bob had been something of a hand with a gun, he definitely had not been a soldier, or even an Indian fighter. Moreover, they had not expected an all-out battle for the town. Whatever the reason, he had committed a fatal error, for that pile of boulders and brush offered almost perfect concealment while affording complete coverage of the town, its one street, and the back, as well as front, of most of the buildings. Keith had been quick to see this on his earlier visits to the town, and had planned to have Poinsett and Starrett approached the place some time before the main force moved in. In this, owing to their own experience, they had been successful. Poinsett finished his cigarette and took up his rifle, then settled down to carefully watching and checking of the time. He had his orders, and they were explicit. He was to fire on the first target offered after 2:30, and his first shot must kill. Shad and Kedrick had returned to the saloon, and Pitt Lane was loitering in front. Day had gone across the street. Lane was in a position out of sight of Poinsett, but the latter had glimpsed Day. The Welshman, however, offered only a fleeting target, and Poinsett did not consider firing. His chance came at once, however. The door of one of the nearest shacks opened, and a man came out. He wore a broad-brimmed gray hat, torn at the crown, and a large checked shirt tucked into jeans supported by suspenders. He turned at the door and kissed his wife. Poinsett took careful aim with his 56, choosing as his target point the man's left suspender buckle. Taking a good deep breath, he held it and squeezed off his shot. The big bullet struck with a heavy thump. The man took a lurch sidewise, tried to straighten, then went down. His wife ran from the door, screaming. Up the street, a door banged, and two men ran into the street, staring. Starrett's first shot knocked the rifle from the hand of one, splintering the stock. Poinsett dropped his man, but the fellow began to drag himself, favoring one leg that, even at this distance, they could see covered with a dark blotch at the knee. Poinsett was a man without mercy. Coolly and carefully, he squeezed off his second shot. The man stiffened, jerked spasmodically, and lay still.
I miss my man, Alf said, apologetically. But I run to shooting iron.
Poinsett spat, his eyes cold.
Could happen to anybody, he said philosophically. But I figure you burnt him anyways.
Within the saloon, Kedrick had a glass half to his mouth when the shot boomed, followed almost at once by two more, their reports sounding almost as one.
Blazes! Shat whirled. They ain't here yet!
They've been here, Kedrick said with quick realization. He swung to the door, glancing up the street. He saw the body of the last man to fall and, leaning out a bit, glimpsed the other. His lips tightened, for neither man was moving.
Somebody is up the draw, he explained quickly. He's got the street covered. Is there a back door?
Kedrick dove for the door, followed by the others once the bartender indicated the way, then caught up his shotgun. His pockets were already stuffed with shells. At the door, Kedrick halted, then, flattened against the wall, stared up the draw. From here he could see the edge of the bunch of boulders and guessed the fire came from there.
Pinned down, he said. They're up the draw.
Nobody moved. His memory for terrain served him to good purpose now. Recalling the draw, he remembered that it was below the level of the town beyond that point, but right there the boulders offered a perfect firing point. Scattered shots came from down the draw, and nobody spoke. All knew that the three men down there could not long withstand the attack, and would fall back on the town to be taken in the rear. 13. Kedrick made up his mind quickly. Defense of the town was now impossible, and they would be wiped out or burned alive if they attempted to remain here. Shad, he said quickly, get across the street to Day and Pitt. Yell out to the others and get them to fall back, regardless of risk, to the canyon at the foot of Yellow Butte. He took a step back and glanced at the trap door to the roof. The bartender saw the intent and shook his head.
You can't do it, boy. They'd get you from down the crick.
I'm going to chance it. I think they are still too far off. If I can give you folks covering fire, you may make it.
What about you?
Shad demanded.
I'll make it. Get moving.
Laredo wheeled and darted to the door, paused an instant, and lunged across the street. The bartender hesitated, swore softly, then followed. Kedrick picked up a bottle of the liquor and shoved it into his shirt, then jumped for the edge of the trap door, caught it, and pulled himself through into the small attic. Carefully, he studied the situation. Hot firing came from downstream, and evidently the killers were momentarily stopped there. He hoisted himself through, swung to the ridge of the roof, and carefully studied the boulders. Suddenly, he caught a movement, and knew that what he had first believed to be a gray rock was actually a shirt. He took careful aim with his Winchester, then fired. The gray shirt jumped, and a hand flew up, then fell loose. Instantly, a Spencer boomed, and a bullet tore a chunk from the ridgepole near his face and splattered him with splinters. Kedrick moved down roof a bit, then, catching the signal from the window across the street, he deliberately shoved his rifle and head up and fired four fast shots, then two more. Ducking his head, he reloaded the Winchester. Another bullet smashed the ridgepole, and then a searching fire began, the heavy slugs tearing through the roof about 3 to 4 inches below the top. Kedrick slid down the roof, hesitated at the edge of the trapdoor, and, seeing a distant figure circling to get behind the men in the wash, he took careful aim and squeezed off his shot. It was all of 500 yards, and he had only a small bit of darkness at which to aim. The shot kicked up sand short of the mark by a foot or more, as nearly as he could judge, and he knew he had missed. But the would-be sniper lost his taste for his circling movement and slid out of sight. Kedrick went down the trapdoor and dropped again into the livery stable office. Regretfully, he glanced at the stock of whiskey, then picked up two more bottles and stuffed them into his pockets. Hesitating only a second, he lunged across the way for the shelter of the livery stable. The Spencer boomed, and he knew that the hidden marksman had been awaiting this effort. He felt the shock of the bullet, staggered, but kept going. Reaching the livery stable, he felt the coldness of something on his stomach and glanced down. The bottle in his shirt had been broken by the bullet, and he smelled to high heaven of good whiskey. Picking the glass out of his shirt, he located his horse's stall, led the Appaloosa out into the runway, and swung into the saddle. Spencer boomed, again and again, as he hit the road, riding hard, but he made it. The others cheered as he rode pell-mell through the canyon mouth and swung to the ground.
"This is no good," Lane said. "They can get behind us on the ridge."
Two men limped in from the draw, having withdrawn from boulder to boulder. Kedrick glanced around. There were 14 men and women here, who were on their feet. One man, who had had a rifle knocked from his hand, had a shattered arm. The others were slightly wounded. Of them all, he had only 7 men able to fight. Quickly, he gave directions for their retreat. Then, with Day and Shad to hold the canyon mouth and cover them, they started back up the canyon. Tom Kedrick measured his group thoughtfully. Of Laredo, Day, and Lane, he had no doubts at all. Of these others, he could not be sure. Good men, some of them, and one or two were obviously frightened. Nobody complained, however, and one of the men whose face was pale took a wounded man's rifle and gave him a shoulder on which to lean. He led them to the crevasse and down into it. Amazed, they stared around.
"What do you know?" the bartender spat. "Been here nigh 7 year, and never knowed of this place."
There were 4 horses with the group, and they brought them all into the cave. One of the men complained, but Kedrick turned on him. "There's water, but we may be glad to eat horse meat." The man swallowed and stared. Lane pointed at Kedrick's shirt.
"Man, you're bleeding."
Kedrick grinned.
"This ain't blood, it's whiskey. They busted one of the bottles I brought away."
Pitt chuckled.
"I'd most as soon as it was blood," he said. "Seems a waste of good liquor."
The 7 able men gathered near the escape end of the crevasse, and one of them grinned at Kedrick.
"I wondered how you got away so slick. Is there another way out down here?"
He shook his head. "If there is, I don't know it. I waited and got out through the canyon when it wasn't watched." Lane's face was serious. "They could hold us here," he said anxiously. "We'd be stuck for sure." Kedrick nodded. "I'm taking an extra canteen and some grub, then I'm going atop the butte to join Bert Williams. I'd like one man with me. From up there, we can hold them off, I think."
"I'm your man," Laredo said quietly. "Wait till I get my gear."
A rifle boomed, and then Day Reed joined them.
"They are coming up," he said.
He glanced at Kedrick.
"One man is dead in the boulders. I got the look of him by my glass. It was Alf Starrett. Poinsett was the other."
"Starrett was a skunk,"
Burnett, one of the settlers, said.
"A low-down skunk. He killed a man up Kansas way, and a man disappeared from his outfit once that occasioned considerable doubt if he didn't get himself another."
Kedrick turned to Pitt Lane.
"Looks like your showdown here," he said. "Don't open fire until you have to. And don't fire even one shot unless it's needed. We'll be on top."
He led the way out of the crevasse and into the boulders and brush behind it. There was no sign of the attackers, and he surmised they were holed up, awaiting the arrival of some supporting fire from the rim back of the canyon. Tom glanced up at the towering butte. It reared itself all of 150 feet above him, and most of it totally without cover. As they waited, a rifle boomed high above them, and there was a puff of dust in the canyon mouth. Bert Williams had opened up in spite of his wounded arm. Yet their first move toward the butte drew fire, and Laredo drew back.
"No chance. We'll have to wait until dark. You reckon they'll hit us before then?"
"If they do, they won't get far."
Tom Kedrick hunkered well down among the slabs of rock at the foot of the butte.
"We've got us a good firing point right here."
He rolled a smoke and lit up.
"What are you planning when this is over, Shad? Do you plan to stay here?"
The tall Texan shrugged.
"I ain't pondered it much. Reckon that'll take care of itself."
"What are you aiming to do?"
"You know the Mogollon southwest of here?
I figured I'd go down there and lay out a ranch for myself."
He smoked thoughtfully.
"Down in East Texas, before I came west, a fellow arrived there named Eichard. Had some white-faced cattle with him. And you should see them. Why, they have more beef on one sorry critter than 3 longhorns. I figured a man could get himself a few Hereford bulls and start a herd. Might even buy 50 or 60 head for a beginning, and let them mix with the longhorns if they like."
"I might go for something like that," Laredo said quietly.
"Always wanted to own a ranch.
Fact is, I started one once, but had to get shut of it.
He studied the end of his cigarette.
That was in the Texas Panhandle, away south of Tascosa. Quite a distance. It was rough country. I mean, rough to live in, not rough like this. Why, you could stand on your front step down that way and see straight ahead for 3 days. Coyotes? Why, you should see them. They'd whoop a grizzly, or near it, and make these coyotes around here look like jackrabbits.
He stared down the canyon toward the mouth, his rifle across his knees. He did not look at Kedrick, but he commented casually,
"We need luck, Captain. Plenty of luck."
"Uh-huh." Kedrick's face was sober.
"Right now we're bottled up, and believe me, Berwick will stop at nothing. I wonder who was on watch up the canyon, or supposed to be."
"Somebody said his name was Hurst. Sallow-faced hombre."
"We'll have to talk to him. Was he down below?"
"Come to think of it, he wasn't. He must have hid out back there.
Or sold out. Remember Singer? He wouldn't have been the only one."
Laredo rubbed out the last of his cigarette.
"They'll be making their play soon. You know, Kedrick, I'd as soon make a break for it, get a couple of horses, and head for Mustang. When we go, we might as well take Keith and that dirty Berwick with us."
Kedrick nodded in agreement, but he wasn't thinking of the men below. There were at least 4 good men aside from Shad, Lane, and Day Reed. That left the numbers not too unevenly balanced. The fighting skill and numbers were slightly on the enemy's side, as they had at least 12 men when the battle opened, and they had lost Starrett. That made the odds 11-8 unless they had moved up extra men, which was highly probable. Still, they were expecting defense, not an attack. He studied the situation. Suddenly a dark figure loomed on the rim of the canyon some 150 yards off, and much higher. He lifted his rifle and fired even as both Shad and Kedrick threw down on him with rifles, firing instantly. The man vanished, but whether hit or not, they could not tell. Desultory firing began, and from time to time they caught glimpses of men advancing from the canyon mouth, but never in sight long enough to offer a target, and usually rising from the ground some distance from where they dropped. The afternoon was drawing on, however, and the sun was setting almost in the faces of the attackers, which made their aim uncertain and their movements hesitant. Several times Shad or Kedrick dusted the oncoming party, but got in no good shots. Twice a rifle boomed from the top of the butte, and once they heard a man cry out as though hit. "You know, Laredo," Kedrick said suddenly, "it goes against the grain to back up for those coyotes. I'm taking this grub up to Bert, and when I come back, we're going to move down that canyon and see how much stomach they've got for a good scrap." Shad grinned, his eyes flickering with humor.
"That's ace high with me, partner," he said dryly. "I never was no hand for a hole, and the women are safe."
"All but one," Kedrick said. "That Mrs. Taggart, who lives in that first house, her husband got killed and she wouldn't leave."
"Yeah, heard one of the women folks speak on it. That Taggart never had a chance. Good folks, those two."
Colonel Loren Keith stared gloomily at the towering mass of Yellow Butte. That man atop the butte had them pinned down. Now, if they could just get up there. He thought of the men he had commanded in years past, and compared them with these outlaws. A pack of murderers. How had he got into this anyway? Why couldn't a man know when he took a turning where it would lead him? It seemed so simple in the beginning, to run off a bunch of ungalloused farmers and squatters. Wealth. He had always wanted wealth, the money to pay his way in the circles where he wanted to travel. But somehow it had always eluded him, and this had seemed a wonderful chance. Bitterly, he stared at the butte, and remembered the greasy edge of Berwick's shirt collar, and the malice in his eyes. Berwick, he used men as he saw fit, and disposed of them when he was through. In the beginning, it hadn't seemed that way. His own commanding presence, his soldier's stride, his cold clarity of thought, all these left him despising Gunter as a mere businessman, and Berwick
as a conniving weakling. But then, Berwick began to show his true self, and all ideas of controlling the whole show left Keith while he stared in shocked horror as the man unmasked. Alton Berwick was no dirty weakling, no mere ugly fat man, but a monster of evil, a man with a brain like a steel trap, stopping at nothing, and by his very depth of wickedness, startling Keith into obedience. Gunter had wanted to pull out. Only now would Keith admit even to himself the cause of Gunter's death, and he knew he would die as quickly. How many times had he not seen the malevolence in the eyes of Dorney Shaw? And well, he knew how close Shaw stood to Berwick. In a sense, they were two of a kind. His feeling of helplessness shocked and horrified Keith. He had always imagined himself a strong man, and he had gone his way, domineering and supercilious. Now he saw himself as only a tool in the hands of a man he despised, yet unable to escape. Deep within him there was the hope that they still would pull their chestnuts out from the fire and take the enormous profit the deal promised. One man stood large in his mind. One man drew all his anger, his hate, and bitterness. That man was Tom Kedrick. From that first day, Kedrick had made him seem a fool. Keith had endeavored to put Kedrick firmly in his place, speaking of his rank and his 12 years of service, and then Kedrick had calmly paraded such an array of military experience that few men could equal, and right before them all. He had not doubted Kedrick, for vaguely now he remembered some of the stories he had heard of the man. That the stories were true, and that Kedrick was a friend of Ransom's, infuriated him still more. He stepped into the makeshift saloon and poured a drink, staring at it gloomily. Fessenden came in, Goff with him. "We going to rouse them out of there, Colonel?" Goff asked. "It'll be dark soon." Keith tossed off his drink. "Yes, right away. Are the rest of them out there?" "All but Poinsett. He'll be along." Keith poured another stiff shot and tossed it off as quickly, then followed them into the street of Yellow Butte. They were all gathered there, but the Mixus boys, who had followed along toward the canyon, and a couple of the newcomers who had circled to get on the cliff above and beyond the boulders and brush where the squatters had taken refuge. Poinsett was walking down the road in long strides. He was abreast of the first house when a woman stepped from the door. She was a square-built woman in a faded blue cotton dress and man's shoes, run down at the heel. She held a double-barreled shotgun in her hands, and, as Poinsett drew abreast of her, she turned on him and fired both barrels at point-blank range, and Poinsett took them right through the middle. Almost torn in two, he hit the ground, gasping once, his blood staining the gray gravel before their shocked eyes. The woman turned on them, and they saw that she was no longer young. Her square face was red, and a few strands of graying hair blew about her face. As she looked at them, her work-roughened hands still clutching the empty shotgun, she motioned at the fallen man in the faded, checked shirt. At that moment, the fact that she was fat, growing old, and that her thick legs ended in the grotesque shoes seemed to vanish, and in the blue eyes were no tears, only her chin trembling a little as she said, "He was my man. Taggart never give me much, and he never had it to give, but in his own way he loved me. You killed him, all of you. I wish I had more shells." She turned her back on them, and without another glance, went into the house and closed the door behind her. They stood in a grim half-circle then, each man faced suddenly with the enormity of what they were doing and had done. Lee Goff was the first to speak. He stood, spraddle-legged, his thick, hard body bulging all his clothes, his blonde hair bristling. "Anybody bothers that woman," he said, "I'll kill him." 14. Keith led his attack just before dusk and lost two men before they withdrew, but not before they learned of the hole. Dorney Shaw squatted behind the abutment formed by the end wall of the canyon where it opened, on the plain near the arroyo. "That makes it easy," he said. "We still got dynamite." Keith's head came up, and he saw Shaw staring at him, his eyes queerly alight.
Or does that go against the grain, Colonel? About 10 sticks of dynamite dropped in that crevasse, and Berwick will get what he wants. No bodies.
If there's a cave back there, Keith objected, they'd be buried alive. Nobody replied. Keith's eyes wandered around to the other men, but their eyes were on the ground. They were shunning responsibility for this, and only Shaw enjoyed it. Keith shuddered. What a fool he had been to get mixed up in this.
A horse's hoof struck stone, and as one man they looked up. Saddle leather creaked, although they could not see the horse. A spur jingled, and Alton Berwick stood among them.
Lauren Keith straightened to his feet and briefly explained the situation. Berwick nodded from time to time, then added,
Use the dynamite. First thing in the morning. That should end it once and for all.
He drew a cigar from his pocket and bit off the end.
Out of wire. That committee is coming out, all right. Take him a couple of weeks to get here. And by that time, folks should be over this and talking about something else. I'm figuring a bonus for you all.
He turned back toward his horse, then stopped and, catching Dorney Shaw's eye, jerked his head. Shaw got up from the fire and followed him, and Keith stared after them, his eyes bitter. Now what? Was he being left out of something else? Beyond the edge of the firelight and beyond the reach of their ears, Berwick paused and let Shaw come up to him.
Nice work, Dorney, he said. We make a pair, you and me.
Yeah, Dorney nodded. And sometimes I think a pair's enough.
Well,
Berwick puffed on his cigar.
I need a good man to side me, and Gunter's gone, at least.
That company of yours, Dorney was almost whispering, had too many partners anyway.
Berwick said quietly. It still has.
All right, then.
Dorney hitched his guns into a firmer seating on his thighs.
I'll be in to see you in a couple of days at most.
Berwick turned and walked away, and Dorney saw him swing easily to the saddle, but it was all very indistinct in the darkness. He stayed where he was, watching the darkness and listening to the slow steps of the horse. They had a funny sound, a very funny sound. When he walked back to the campfire, he was whistling Green Grow the Lilacs. The attack came at daybreak, and the company had mustered 20 men, of whom 2 carried packages of dynamite. This was to be the final blow, to wipe out the squatters once and for all. Shortly before the arrival of Berwick, Keith and Dorney Shaw, with Fessenden accompanying them, had made a careful reconnaissance of the canyon from the rim. What they found pleased them enormously. It was obvious, once the crevasse had been located, that not more than 2 men could fire from it at once, and there was plenty of cover from the scattered boulders. In fact, they could get within throwing distance without emerging in the open for more than a few seconds at a time. Much of the squatter's field of fire would be ruined by their proximity to the ground and the rising of the boulders before them. The attack started well with all the men moving out, and they made 20 yards into the canyon, moving fast. Here, the great slabs fallen from the slope of Yellow Butte crowded them together. And there, the attack stopped. It stopped abruptly, meeting a withering wall of rifle fire at point-blank range. Tom Kedrick knew a thing or two about fighting, and he knew full well that his hideout would, in the long run, become a death trap. He put himself in Keith's place and decided what that man would do. Then he had his 8 men, carrying 14 rifles, slip like Indians through the darkness to carefully selected firing positions far down the canyon from where Keith would be expecting them. 5 of the attackers died in that first burst of fire, and as the gun hands broke for cover, 2 more went down, and 1 dragged himself to the camp of the previous night with a shattered kneecap. He found himself alone. The wife of Taggart had begun it. The mighty blast of rifle fire completed it. The company fighters got out of the canyon's mouth, and as 1 man they moved for their horses, Keith among them, and glad to be going. Dorney Shaw watched him mount up and swung up alongside him. Behind them, moving carefully, as if they were perfectly disciplined troops, the defenders of the canyon moved down, firing as they came. A horse dropped, and a man crawled into the rocks, then jumped up and ran. Day Reed swung wide at the group and started after him. Another went down before they got away, and Kedrick turned to his group.
Get your horses, men. The women will be all right. This is a job that needs finishing now.
A quarter of a mile away, Brokaw spotted a horse, standing alone, and started for it. As he arose from the rocks, a voice called out from behind,
A minute!
Brokaw turned. There was only one man approaching him, the Welshman, Day Reed. He stared at the man Spencer, remembering his own gun was empty. He backed up slowly, his eyes haunted.
My rifle's empty, he said, and I've lost my Colt.
Drop the rifle, then, Day said quietly. This I've been wanting, for guns be not my way. Brokaw did not understand, but he dropped his rifle. He was a big man, hulking and considered powerful. He watched in amazement as Reed placed his Spencer carefully on the ground, and then his gun belt. With bow-legged strides, the shorter man started for Brokaw. The outlaw stared, then started forward to meet Day. As they drew near, he swung. His rock-like fist smashed Day Reed flush on the chin, and Reed only blinked, then lunged. Twice more, Brokaw swung, blows filled with smashing panic born of the lack of effect of that first punch. Day seemed unable to avoid them, and both connected solidly, and then his huge, big-knuckled hand grasped Brokaw's arm and jerked him near. The hand slipped to the back of his head and jerked Brokaw's face down to meet the rising of the Welshman's head. Stars burst before Brokaw's eyes, and he felt the bone go in his nose. He swung wildly, and then those big hands gripped his throat and squeezed till Brokaw was dead. Then Day Reed dropped the outlaw to the sand, and, turning, he walked away. He did not notice the horse that stood waiting. It was a Gruya. In the headlong flight that followed the debacle in the canyon's mouth, only Lee Goff had purpose. The hard-bitten Montana gunman had stared reality in the face when Taggart's wife turned on him. It was only coincidence that she so resembled his own mother, long since dead of overwork and rearing 7 boys and 5 girls on a bleak Montana ranch. He headed directly for Yellow Butte and the Taggart home. He did not dismount, only he stopped by the door and knocked gently. It opened, and he faced Mrs. Taggart, her eyes red now from weeping.
Ma'am, he said, I guess I ain't much account, but this here's been too much. I'm drifting. Will you take this here, as a favor to me?
He shoved a thick roll of bills at her, his face flushing deep red. For an instant, she hesitated, and then she accepted the money with dignity.
Thanks, son. You're a good boy.
There's an old Mormon trail across northern New Mexico into Colorado and Utah. Lee Goff's bald-faced sorrel stirred the dust on that road all the way across 2 states before its rider began to look the country over. Behind him, had he known, Tom Kedrick was riding the Mustang. With him were Laredo Shad, Pitt Lane, Day Reed, Burt Williams, and the others. They made a tight, grim-faced little cavalcade, and they rode with their rifles across their saddle forks. Due west of them, had they only known, another little drama was taking place, for the riders they followed were not all the riders who had abandoned the fight in the canyon. 2 of them, Dorney Shaw and Colonel Lauren Keith, had headed due west on their own. Both men had their own thoughts and their own ideas of what to do. And among other things, Keith had decided that he had had enough. Whether the others knew it or not, they were through, and he was getting out of the country. There was some money back there in Mustang, and once he had that, he was going to mount up and head for California. Then, let Ransom investigate. After a few years, he would return to the East, and if the subject ever came up, he would swear he had nothing to do with it, that he only represented them legally in the first steps of the venture. What Dorney Shaw was thinking, nobody ever guessed. And at this moment, he had no thought at all in his mind, for his mind was not overly given to thought. He liked a few things, although he rarely drank, and seemed never to eat much. He liked a good horse and a woman with about the same degree of affection, and he had liked Sue Lane a good bit, but the woman who really fascinated him was Connie Duane, who never seemed aware that he was even alive. Most of all, he liked a gun. When cornered or braced into a fight, he killed as naturally and simply as most men eat. He was a creature of destruction, pure and simple. Never in his life had he been faced with the man who made him doubt his skill, and never fought with anything but guns, and he vowed he never would. The two rode rapidly, and both were mounted well, so by the time Kedrick was leaving Yellow Butte and lining out for town, they reached the bank of Salt Creek Wash. Here, Keith swung down to tighten his saddle cinch while his horse was drinking. After a moment, Dorney got down too. Absently, Keith asked,
"Well, Dorney, this breaks it. So where do you think you'll go now?"
"Why, Colonel," Shaw said softly, in his gentle boy's voice, "I don't know exactly where I'm going, but this here's as far as you go."
It took a minute for the remark to sink in, and then Keith turned, his puzzled expression stiffening into blank horror, then fear. Dorney Shaw stood negligently watching him, his lips smiling a little, his eyes opaque and empty. The realization left Lorne Keith icy cold. Dorney Shaw was going to kill him. He had been an utter fool ever to allow this to happen. Why had he left the others and come off with Shaw? Why hadn't he killed him long since, from behind if need be, for the man was like a mad dog? He was insane. Completely insane.
"What's on your mind, Shaw?" Without realizing it, he spoke as he might to a subordinate.
Shaw was not conscious of the tone. He was looking at Keith's belt line. The colonel, he reflected, had been taking on a little weight here lately.
"Why, just what I say. You've come as far as your trail takes you, Colonel. I can't say I'm sorry."
"Berwick won't like this. We're two of the men on whom he relies."
"Uh-huh. That's the way it was. It ain't now. Back yonder," he jerked his head toward the butte, "he sort of implied he'd got himself one too many partners."
He shoved his hat back a little.
"You want to try for your gun? It won't help you none, but you can try."
Keith was frightened. Every muscle within him seemed to have tightened until he could not move, yet he knew he was going to. But at the last, he had something to say, and it came from some deep inner conviction. "Kedrick will kill you, Dorney. He's going to win. He'll kill Berwick, too." Suddenly, he remembered something. It had been only a fleeting expression on Dorney Shaw's face, but something.
"Dorney!"
He shot the word out with the force of desperation.
"There behind you! The Gruya!"
Shaw whirled, his face white, an almost animal-like fury on it. As he turned, Keith gasped hoarsely and triumphantly, and his gun swung up, but he had never coped with a fighter like Shaw. In the flashing instant that he whirled and found nothing behind him, Dorney hurled himself backward. The shot split wide the air where he had stood an instant before, and then Dorney himself fired from the ground, fired once, then a second time. Keith caught the bullet through the midsection, right where that extra weight had been gathering, and took the second one in the same place. He fell, half in the trickle of water that comprised Salt Creek. Feeding shells into his gun, Dorney Shaw stared down at the glazing eyes.
"How did you know?" he asked sullenly. "How did you know?"
15. Fessenden rode well forward in the saddle. His great bulk carried easily with the movement of the horse. His wide face was somber with thought and distaste. Like the others, the wife of Taggart had affected him as nothing else could have. He was a hard man who had done more than his share of killing. But he had killed men ruthlessly, thoughtlessly, men in mortal combat where he himself might die as easily. Several times before he had hired his gun, but each time in cattle or sheep wars or struggles with equals, men as gun-wise as he himself. Never before had he actually joined in a move to rob men of their homes. Without conscience in the usual sense, he had it in this case, for the men who moved west, regardless of their brand, were largely men in search of homes. Before, he had thought little of their fight. Several times he had helped to drive nesters from cattle range, and to him that was just and logical, for cows needed grass and people lived on beef, and most of the range country wasn't suited to farming anyway. But in this case, there was a difference, he now realized, thinking of it for the first time. In this case, men were not being driven off for cattle, but only for profit. To many, The line was a fine one to draw. To Fessenden and his like, once the matter was seen in its true light, that line became a gap. An enormous one. Actually, he rode in a state of shock. The victory Keith had wanted seemed so near. The taking of the few left in the canyon had seemed simple. His qualms against the use of dynamite he had shrugged off, if uncomfortably. Yet he had gone into the canyon with the others to get the thing over with, to get his money, and get out. And then, long before they expected it, came that smashing, thunderous volley, made more crashing by the close canyon walls, more destructive by the way the attackers were channeled by the boulders. Shock started the panic, and distaste for the whole affair kept some of them, at least, on the move. Yet it was hard to believe that Clausen and Poinsett were dead, that Brokaw had vanished, that Lee Goff was gone. For alone of the group, Goff had told Fessenden he was leaving. He had not needed to tell him why. Behind him rode the Mixus boys, somber with disappointment at the failure of the attack. They had no qualms about killing, and no lines to draw even at the killing of women. They were in no true sense fighting men. They were butchers. Yet even they realized the change that had come over the group. What had become of Brokaw or Goff, they did not know. Only that disintegration had set in, and these men had turned into a snarling pack of wolves, venting their fury and their hatred on each other. Mustang was quiet when they rode into town. It was the quiet before the storm. And the town, like that cattle buyer who had turned back to Durango, sensed the coming fury of battle. No women were on the street, and only a few hardy souls loitered at the bars or card tables. The chairs before St. James were deserted, and Clay Allison had ridden back to his home ranch, drunk and ugly. An almost Sunday peace lay over the town when Fessenden drew up before the Mustang Saloon and swung down from his weary horse. Slapping his hat against his leg to beat off the dust, Fessenden stood like a great shaggy bull and surveyed the quiet of the street. He was too knowing a Western man not to recognize the symptoms of disaster. Clapping his hat all awry upon his shaggy head, he moved his bulk through the doors and moved to the bar.
"Rye," he said, his voice booming in the cavernous interior.
His eyes glinted around the room, then back to the bartender. That worthy could no longer restrain his curiosity.
"What happened?"
he asked, swallowing. A glint of irony came into the hard eyes of the gunman.
"Them squatters squatted there for keeps,"
he said wryly.
"And they showed us they aimed to stay put."
He tossed off his drink.
"All hell busted loose."
Briefly, he explained.
"You'd have figured there was 1,000 men in that neck of the rocks when they opened up. The thing that did it was the unexpectedness of it, like stepping on a step in the dark when it ain't there."
He poured another drink.
"It was that Kedrick," he said grimly. "When I seen him shift to the other side, I should have lit a shuck."
"What about Keith?"
"He won't be back." They turned at the new voice and saw Dorney Shaw standing in the doorway, smiling. Still smiling, he walked in and leaned against the bar. "Keith won't be back," he said. "He went for his gun out on Salt Creek." The news fell into a silent room. A man at a table shifted his feet and a chair creaked. Fessenden wet his lips and downed his second drink. He was getting out of town, but fast.
"Seen that girl come in, short time back," the bartender said suddenly. "That Duane girl. Thought she'd gone over to the other side."
Dorney's head lifted and his eyes brightened, then shadowed. He downed his own drink and walked jauntily to the door.
"Stick around, Fess. I'll be back," he grinned. "I'll collect for both of us from the old man."
The bartender looked at Fessenden.
"Reckon he'll bring it if he does?"
The big man nodded absently.
"Sure. He's no thief. Why, that kid never stole a thing in his life. He doesn't believe in it, and he wouldn't lie or swear. But he'll shoot the heart out of you and smile right in your face while he's doing it."
The show had folded. The roundup was over. There was nothing to do now but light out. Fessenden knew he should go, but a queer apathy had settled over him, and he ordered another drink, letting the bartender pour it. The liquor he drank seemed now to fall into a cavern without bottom, having no effect. On the outskirts of town, Tom Kedrick reined in. "We'll keep together," he said quietly. "We want Keith, Shaw, Berwick, the Mixus boys, and Fessenden. There are about four others that you will know that I don't know by name. Let's work fast and no mistakes. Pitt, you take Day and two men and go up the left side of the street. Take no chances. Arrest them if you can. We'll try them and—" His face was grim. "If we find them guilty, they'll have just two sentences. Leave the country or hang. The Mixus boys and Shaw," he said, "will hang. They've done murder." He turned in his saddle and glanced at the tall Texan. "Come on, Chad," he said. "We'll take two men and the right side of the street, which means the livery stable, the St. James, and the Mustang." Kedrick glanced over at Lane. "Pitt," he said, "if you run into Allison or catch him, better leave him alone. We don't want him." Lane's face was grave. "I ain't hunting him," he said grimly. "But if they want it, they can have it." The parties rode into town and swung down on their respective sides of the street. Laredo grinned at Kedrick, but his eyes were sober. "Nobody wants to cross Lane today," he said quietly. "The man's in a killing mood. It's his sister. Wonder what will happen when they meet." "I hope they don't," Shad said. "She's a right purty sort of gal, only money crazy." The two men with him stood hesitantly, waiting for orders. Both were farmers. One carried a Spencer 56, the other a shotgun. Shad glanced at them. "Let these hombres cover the street, Tom," he suggested. "You take the St. James, and I'll take the stable." Kedrick hesitated. "All right," he agreed finally. "But take no chances, boy." Laredo grinned and waved a negligent hand and walked through the wide door of the stable. Inside, he paused, cold and seemingly careless, but actually as poised and deadly as a coiled rattler. He had already seen Abe Mix's sorrel pony and guessed the two dry gulchers were in town. He walked on a step and saw the barrel of a rifle pushed through the hay. He lunged right and dove into a stall, drawing his gun as he went, and ran full tilt into the other Mixus. Their bodies smashed together, and Mixus, caught off balance, went down and rolled over. He came up, clawing for a gun. Laredo kicked the gun from under his hand and sent it spinning into the wide-open space between the rows of stalls. With a kind of whining fury, Bean Mixus sprang after it, slid to his knees, and got up, turning. Laredo Shad stood, tall and dark, just within the stall, and, as Mixus turned like a rat cornered and swung his gun around, Laredo fired, his two shots slamming loudly into the stillness of the huge barn. Bean Mixus fell dead. The rifle bellowed, and a shot ripped the stall stanchion near Laredo's head. He lunged into the open, firing twice more at the stack of straw. The rifle jerked, then thundered again, but the shot went wild. Laredo dove under the loft where Abe Mixus was concealed and fired two more shots through the roof over his head where he guessed the killer would be lying. Switching his guns, he holstered the empty one and waited. The roof creaked some distance away, and he began to stalk the escaping Mixus, slipping from stall to stall. Suddenly a back door creaked and a broad path of light shot into the darkness of the stable. Laredo lunged to follow. Too late. The farmer outside with the shotgun was the man Sloan. As Abe Mixus lunged through the door to escape, he came face to face at no more than 20 feet of distance. Abe had his rifle at his hip and he fired. The shot ripped through the water trough beside Sloan, and the farmer squeezed off the left-hand barrel of his shotgun. The solid core of shot hit Mixus in the shoulder and neck, knocking him back against the side of the door, his neck and shoulder a mass of blood that seemed to well from a huge wound. He thought to get his gun up, but Sloan stepped around, remembering Bob McLennan's death and the deaths of Steelman and Slagle. The other barrel thundered, and a sharp blast of flame stabbed at Abe Mixus. Smashed and dead, the killer sagged against the door jamb, his old hat falling free, his face pillowed in the gray, blood-mixed dust. Silence hung heavily in the wake of the shots. Into that silence, Laredo Shad spoke. "Hold it, Sloan." He stepped through the door, taking no glance at the fallen man. "The other one won't hang either," he said. They were both inside. The two men drew aside. Sloane's face, gray and sick. He had never killed a man before, and wanted never to again. He tried to roll a smoke, but his fingers trembled. Shad took the paper and tobacco from him and rolled it. The farmer looked up shamefacedly.
"Guess I'm Yowler," he said. "That sort of got me."
The Texan looked at him gloomily.
"Let's hope it always does," he said.
He handed him the cigarette.
"Try this," he told him. "It'll make you feel better."
"Wonder how Kendrick's coming."
"I ain't heard nothing."
Pitt Lane stood in a door across the street.
"Everything all right?"
he called.
"Yeah,"
the other farmer called back.
"Only you don't have to look for the Mixus boys no more. They ain't gonna be around."
Captain Tom Kedrick had walked up the street and turned into the door of the St. James Hotel. The wide lobby was still, a hollow shell smelling faintly of old tobacco fumes and leather. The wrinkled clerk looked up and shook his head.
"Quiet today," he said. "Nobody around."